We'd like to just turn the evening over to Dr. Harold Slusher.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction. Certainly a pleasure to be again here in your church. It has been a few years, 3 or 4, something like that. I think. You know, your pastor was talking about this business of time and how it passes and metabolism and so forth. Tonight, in some of my remarks, I'm going to mention entropy, you know, and entropy is a measure of disorder, a loss of form and body and complexity and arrangement. And entropy seems to work on us all. We never break even with it. I was lecturing at Humboldt State University up at Eureka back in February, and a fellow who had heard me lecture some years ago down in San Diego remarked that entropy had made a great change in me. He said I had changed immensely. Well, your pastor doesn't look like he has changed very much, but certainly time seems to fly. Sometimes it drags. My students say it drags. To me, it always seems to fly a bit. Well, again, it is a real pleasure to be back here, and it's certainly a great honor to be invited to this church. I'm up here to lecture at the University of California at Irvine tomorrow night. Tonight, I'm with a friendly crowd. Tomorrow night, I may wish I'd brought my bulletproof vest along and worn it and had some bodyguards to get me out. Once upon a time, I lectured in Michigan at a university, and the natives were really restless that night. By the time I had gotten through, I had urged the fellow who had invited me to have the car running, and I'd dash out behind the stage to get out of there as quickly as possible. It was a bit of an exciting night, and perhaps tomorrow night will be similar to that. I'm going to lecture in regard to the time question, how old things are, and if any of you were around when I was here for that debate a few years ago, I made some mention of that then. Tonight, however, I'd like to take a look at this matter of the origin of the universe. I'd like to contrast the two positions, the position that the evolutionist maintains for the explanation of the universe, and the position that the creationist holds and what the scriptures maintain in regard to the origin of the universe, and then, if time permits, perhaps talk a little bit about certain aspects of the age of the universe and the age of the earth, the age of things. All of this is extremely important. Certainly the subject is extremely vital and so important to talk about. I remember a year ago, thereabouts, reading an intelligence report that was published by a chain of newspapers in Ireland, the Kilbritton chain. They issue what they call an intelligence brief out of their office in Dublin, and their writer for this particular issue made a certain remark that I think is extremely important. He had been talking about the impact of Romanism in Italy. He had been talking about the effects of, let's say, the preachings and the teachings of the Church of England, in England itself, had been talking about Christianity in the United States, and he made a very significant remark. He said, when the Christians threw in the towel in regard to the matter of Darwinism, you know, some years ago, back in the early 1900s, and gave up the struggle against what Darwinism was teaching, socially, as well as so-called scientifically, he said Christianity lost all of its power. Because he said, what young people in Italy, in Italian universities, what young people in German universities, what young people in British universities or American universities are going to pay any attention to a so-called religion or Christianity that even denies effectively that their God is the creator of the universe and the creator of life and the author of what we see around us so far as this universe is concerned? He said, how can you expect anyone to pay much attention to a message about Jesus Christ if the God of this universe is chance and time and natural selection and disorder and mutations? How can you expect any student to pay much attention to what one says about Christ, the Savior, if he has effectively admitted that the evolutionist is right in his explanation for things, namely that you're the product of chance, that you're the product of blind forces acting over eons and eons of time, that the universe is an accident, the stars are an accident, that galaxies are accidents, that star clusters are accidents, that life itself is an accident, your brain is an accident, and thinking itself is merely an accident. Really, that's what the evolutionist teaches, as a matter of fact. You know, C.S. Lewis once remarked that he thought that was the most remarkable thing. He said, I am not very inclined to pay any attention to a man who says everything is an accident when his thinking is probably an accident. And what is there that would even remotely suggest that an accident, the irrational, produces the rational? So he said, I'm really not very inclined to a man who talks in that fashion to listen to him in regard to it being a matter of truth. Well, I think that fellow who wrote that intelligence report is right. Christianity lost its power. This man went on to remark that until Christians really began to believe that God had created this universe, that chance was not God, that chance did not give rise to what we see around us, he said Christianity will never have any effect, really, in this world. Well, I recall some years ago hearing Dr. Harlow Shapley, who was longtime professor of astronomy at Harvard University. I mentioned Shapley's remark because Shapley and I had one thing in common. For our theses, we both studied the same star. He studied the eclipsing binary star, UZ Cygni, at Princeton University. Some years later, I studied the same star, UZ Cygni, an eclipsing binary star, at the University of Oklahoma. And we both wrote our theses regarding the orbital elements of that star. So we have something in common. Before you smile too much, it's obvious which is the superior of the two schools. Any fraternity team at Oklahoma could beat the best of Princeton on the football field without even half trying. So it's obvious which of the two schools is superior intellectually and otherwise, without a doubt. I could tell you knew that already by the expression on your face when I said we studied at two different schools. But anyway, Harlow Shapley made this remark. I heard Shapley make this remark in a public lecture, and then I read it later on in one of the essays he wrote for a book entitled Adventures in Earth Science. Shapley said, some people very piously record in the beginning God, but I say in the beginning hydrogen. He said, if we have enough hydrogen, and we have the physical laws, such as the law of gravity, the conservation laws dealing with energy and momentum, Newton's three laws of motion, the various chemical laws, he said, we can explain this universe in all its details and be done once and for all with myths and fables about a god or gods creating this universe. Well, that was Shapley's statement, and probably his statement sums up very well the evolutionist position in regard to an explanation of this universe that we see around us and its beginning and its past history. Now, a little bit later on, I want to come back to that statement. The creationist position, of course, is the very opposite of that. The two positions are contradictory in regard to what they say. In this public meeting, by the way, there was some fellow during the question and answer session when Shapley got through. He said, Dr. Shapley, I want to ask a question. He said, you have said you can explain the universe in all its details. You know, if you have hydrogen and the physical laws can give rise to the cosmos, Shapley was saying. He said, first, how would you explain the existence of matter and energy, the hydrogen, and the energy associated with the hydrogen? And secondly, since laws, physical laws, which are descriptions, of course, and there's no need for us to get into a long-winded discussion of what the word law means in physics, it's rather obvious what it means. But anyway, he said, laws seem to imply thinking, and reasoning, and planning. So how would you account for these things, you know, to start with, since you say that you begin with those? Shapley wasn't used to being questioned. He was the dean of American astronomers for quite a long time. He wasn't used to being questioned in that fashion. I wish I'd have been the one who had thought to have gotten up and asked those. I wasn't. I lost my chance for fame right there that night. But anyway, Shapley, in a very irritated and rare voice and a bit of a red face, said, that's a very unfair question. He said, you just have to assume those things. I thought for a man who said he was going to explain the universe in all its details, got off to a bit of a bad start there. in regard to the whole thing. But what Shapley said, and I don't mean to pick on Shapley, even though he and I did have something in common, hopefully the resemblance ends with that matter of that binary eclipsing star. But anyway, Shapley's position sums up the evolutionist position very, very well, without really my adding anything to it. Let me paraphrase Shapley a little bit. If he were here tonight, I'm sure he'd agree with my paraphrasing. And then I'll state the creationist position. Then I'd like to talk a little bit about the Big Bang and certain things like that, and discuss it a bit, and let's see how all of this fares when it gets down to attempting to explain the universe. Shapley is saying that this universe, by just studying it, observing certain things about it, studying the physical laws that seem to be associated with this cosmos, he says by doing that, you can explain its origin, you can explain its beginning, you can explain its past history. He said further, this universe is something that is self-contained. As that, popular song of some years ago, Is That All There Is? I think that was the title of it, or something like that. Shapley's saying, yes, this is all there is. The physical universe is all there is. There is nothing outside it. There is nothing in the way of some sort of supernatural being to interfere in its workings. This is it. When you look at it, when you look at stars, and you look at galaxies, you look at clusters of stars and things of that sort, you're seeing all there is. You're a bit of what? Hydrogen from the explosion of some supernova star, some billions of years ago. You're merely a set of particles held together by gravitational electrical forces. And when you die, the energy associated with you and the matter that make up your body goes back, you know, to the energy pool of the universe. And he is saying, that is all there is to life. You're merely a sephiroephorescence from savagism. You came up or down from ape-like beings, those monkeys that your pastor was talking about a while ago. You came up or down from beings of that sort, and your nature is merely the extension, let's say, to paraphrase rather lightly, a rat's nature, something of that sort. You're merely an animal. And you might be perhaps a bit more advanced than other animals, but nonetheless, this is your status. Therefore, you see, morally and ethically, there are certain things that one would expect of you and not expect of you as well. He's saying that not only did the universe, if it had a finite beginning in time, not only did, let's say, hydrogen and laws sort of pop into existence in some manner or other, but the universe that you see around you arose by the natural working of the physical laws. Gravity acting on matter, momentum and energy associated with the matter, these physical laws shaped the matter, built stars, built clusters of stars, built galaxies, and so forth. And the universe that you see around you came by the action of these physical laws on matter and energy, merely by chance processes. No interference from the outside. A cloud of hydrogen became a star eventually through gravitational collapse. Or from the explosion of a primordial atom or a primeval atom, the universe was born, you know, out of a huge hydrogen cloud that was created by thermonuclear reactions in the early stages of that explosion. All of this, supposedly, the matter and energy acted upon by forces that have nothing to do particularly with reasoning, gave rise to what you see around you. It's as if you went down to the automobile junkyard wanting your Datsun 280ZX, you know, and there are pieces of Datsuns and Chevrolets and Toyotas and Cadillacs and Fords and so forth, and by chance processes of energy pouring into that automobile junkyard, and the various forces that act between the pieces of those automobiles, that somehow or other a Datsun 280ZX arose by chance. Seriously, it is really something of that sort. In other words, it's as if this Accutron watch that I'm wearing, that there were the pieces of it lying around, and by the action of gravitational forces and things of that nature, my watch came into being, you know? Took no planning, took nothing of any sort. You know, a long time ago, before I get off the track too much, a long time ago, Isaac Newton, you know, who discovered Newton's three laws of motion, Newton's law of gravitation, Newton's law of cooling, Newton's rings, you know, in regard to optical effects, nearly everything. Practically all the classical physics has to do with Newton in some way or other. But Newton built one of these little apparatus for illustrating how the planets travel around the sun. You've seen these things. I've forgotten what they're called. But, you know, you can turn a crank and the moon moves around the Earth, and the Earth moves around the Sun, and Venus is down there whizzing around the Sun, and way out there Mars and Jupiter and Saturn. You know, we don't want to go beyond that. Newton didn't know about, you know, what was on past that, so I better not get too many planets in his little gadget there. But anyway, he built one of these. And he had a friend who used to come to visit him. This story is a true story. It's in the Letters of Newton, collected by Bentley. You can read it in any public library, university library. But anyway, this fellow who used to visit Newton maintained that the universe arose by chance. You had a fire cloud, as they used to put it in those days, and somehow or other that fire cloud cooled off, and you got things like stars and groups of stars and so forth. And he used to tell Newton, you know, how the universe had to have just arisen merely by chance processes. Well, when he would come to visit Newton, Newton would turn the crank on this little gadget, and his friend would observe the remarkable aspect of it, and he'd say, what a clever device. He knew Newton had designed it, and he would remark on how clever the fellow must have been who built it as well. Newton would say, no, it just popped into existence. It wasn't built. There it was. The pieces were lying around, and all of a sudden, one day on the table, there it was. And the fellow would get a bit irritated with Newton and remark on how silly he was acting, a bit silly. He didn't tell Newton exactly that he was silly, but that he was acting a bit silly. And so each day he would visit, and Newton would go through the same statement. And finally the fellow said, do you take me for a fool to believe that a remarkable device of this nature could have just arisen by chance? Newton said, the words are yours. Well, these people who say the universe, which is vastly more complicated than any little device like that that Newton built, a universe in which the motions are so extremely complicated that they're beyond understanding nearly, and it's taken astronomers quite a long time to work out the motions. For instance, right now, to just give you an instance of how complicated this universe is, just so far as the motions are concerned, you appear to be very comfortable. But you're rotating around the axis of the Earth at this latitude of between 700 and 800 miles per hour. But I certainly can't tell it by looking at you. And I can't tell it either. I'm rotating too at that speed. And the Earth, at the same time that it's rotating about its axis of rotation, is moving in its orbit about the Sun at a rate of around 30 miles per second. And then the Sun is dragging us through space in the local cluster of stars in the local solar neighborhood, at a rate of about 20 kilometers per second. Once I get away from the Earth, I have to switch back to the metric system. I can never remember anything in miles per hour after that. But anyway, about 20 kilometers per second. And then the local cluster of stars, of which our Sun is a member, is swinging around the center of the galaxy at around 200 to 250 kilometers per second. And our galaxy is moving in the local group of galaxies in a cluster of which we're a member at a rate of about, 400 to 700 kilometers per second. And our cluster is moving through space at a rate of about 7,000 kilometers per second. And if we were to get together here tomorrow night, we'll be about 2 to 3 million miles. If we added up, you know, all the distances that we've moved in different directions, we'd be about 2 to 3 million miles from where we are tonight, 24 hours from now. So you see, the motions are tremendously complicated. Not only are the motions tremendously complicated, but the objects that make up this universe are tremendously complicated. Stars, clusters of stars, galaxies, which are sort of clusters of clusters of stars, you might say, clusters of galaxies, clusters of galaxies, as a matter of fact, and the French astronomer Gérard de Vaucouleurs believes that there are clusters of clusters of galaxies, but certainly they're clusters of clusters. That part you can count on, that level in the whole thing, there's that for sure. But anyway, a hierarchy of complicated objects. And a star is vastly complicated. It generates its energy in a strange fashion, in a very complicated fashion. But you, the amount of information that you possess as compared to the amount of information possessed by a star is no comparison at all. You're infinitely more complex than a star is. A star can't sing like these folks did up here, you know, and play a guitar and things like that. A star doesn't think. A star can't write a sonnet. A star can't write a poem. You're vastly more complicated than a star ever was. But these people are saying that all of this arose merely by chance. By the rolling of the dice, so to speak, over and over for an infinity of time, somehow something is wonderfully complicated, so mysterious, so vast, so intricate, so beyond comprehension nearly in itself. If anybody ever tells you the universe is simple, don't pay a bit of attention to them. It's extremely complicated and hard to understand. But something like that, these people are saying, arose somehow by chance. And furthermore, Shapley would say that things go from simple to complex spontaneously. It goes from chaos to cosmos of its own accord, without any help, so to speak. And finally, Shapley didn't say this in the statement that I quoted, but he would agree to it, I'm sure, if he were here. He would say that it took a long, long time. It took billions upon billions of years for this to happen. Because if things happen by chance processes, it takes huge time, you see, for chance to iron things out or to give you anything that you might want. Now, the creationist position is the opposite. The creationist position says this universe is not self-contained, that there is a being of infinite power, infinite intelligence, infinite ability, and there are many, many more attributes to God. I'm just mentioning a few of them. Outside this whole system that made the system in the first place, the matter and energy in the system. The creationist would maintain that since order will not arise spontaneously in a system, the only thing that arises spontaneously in a system is disorder. The creationist maintains that any order that it possesses, any complexity that it possesses, any information that it possesses, as the communications engineer puts it, is something that had to be put in from the outside. It's not something that will arise spontaneously. You know as well as I do that if you leave a system to itself, what happens? It decays, doesn't it? It deteriorates. I used to be able to run the mile, not in 4 minutes, but after a while, I finally got down to the end of a mile after a number of starts and stops, you know, getting my breath and so forth in the starts and stops, but I used to be able to do it better than I do today. Now I have to work very hard at it, much harder than I had to work then. For a while I grew vertically, but what does one have to worry about after a bit? Growing horizontally. In this universe, there is that strange effect, unfortunately, in which one always has to work against this disordering, this spontaneous loss of form and body, this spontaneous tendency to go toward what? Chaos. You know, there is that in the universe, whether one likes it or not. I tell my students in astronomy about that. Some of them are philosophy majors in the freshman course, and they always find that unpalatable. This idea that things are decaying, running down, deteriorating, degenerating. But that's the way things are, whether one likes it or not, in this universe. It's a universe that is running down. It's a universe in which one must fight, so to speak. You know that very popular phrasing of the second law of thermodynamics, of the entropy law, which I'm talking about. Henry Bent, a professor of chemistry at the University of Minnesota, used to say this. He said, the thing that's happening in this universe could be paraphrased in the following manner. You think things are mixed up now, you ain't seen nothing yet. Or if you think things are bad now, they're going to get much worse. And that's the way the universe tends to go. That's the way physical systems tend to go. That's the way biological systems tend to go. That's the way chemical systems tend to go. Everything tends to go toward disorder. So the creationist maintains if you have order and complexity, since it will not arise spontaneously, it must have been put in from the outside, from a being with the power to put it in from the outside. And then the creationist would maintain that instead of in this universe seeing a development upward, we see a development or a movement downward. We don't see stars being formed in hydrogen clouds. I don't care what you read in the Sunday supplement, the newspaper, Parade magazine, or the American Weekly. Nobody's ever seen a star form in a hydrogen cloud. Now, we've sure seen them explode. We've seen galaxies collide, but we've never seen galaxies form. We've seen comets break up, but we've never seen comets form. We've seen the Earth slowing down this rotation, but we've never seen it speeding up. We've seen the opposite of what the evolutionist talks about. He describes an Alice in Wonderland, topsy-turvy type world that has nothing to do with reality. The real universe is one that is running down. The real universe is one in which there's a loss of form and body and complexity. If I told you tonight, you know, you see now and then in newspapers a statement that at Kitt Peak National Observatory, a gang of astronomers there saw some stars form out in one of the nebula in Orion. And everyone gets very excited. Of course, astronomers know good and well there's no need to get too excited about that, because that's not really what they mean. What they mean is that out in some hot clouds of hydrogen, they suddenly saw some stars. Now, you see, what may have happened there is those huge clouds moving with tremendous velocities through space shifted over, you know, like a curtain going up on the stage, and uncovered some stars that were there from the beginning. It may be just as well to say the hot clouds of hydrogen get spewed out of stars. You know, just as well as saying it the other way. And as a matter of fact, it's a lot better to say it that way, because we've never seen the other happen. Astronomers talk about stars forming. Suppose I told you that as Christopher Chu and I came here tonight, as we were walking through the parking lot, I saw a tiger running loose out there. You might be willing to listen to me for more than an hour. Your pastor told me roughly an hour I could go. You might be willing to listen to me for even longer than that if I told you I saw a tiger. But if at the end of 3 hours of my carrying on, I couldn't go that far, I can only talk 50 minutes. Professors talk, you know, in 50-minute intervals, and at 10 minutes till the hour, the bell always rings in my mind, you know, and I'm ready. My students are violent after 50 minutes. They're ready to get loose and charge for the door, and it's embarrassing if they beat me to the door. So I always stop right on the dot at 50 minutes. But anyway, if then at the end of 3 hours I confess to you all I saw were some scratch marks out there on the pavement that I interpreted as tiger, you know, that some tiger was sharpening up his claws there, you might be in a rather bad mood with me. It might be one of those nights in which I'd have to get out of here in a hurry again. But there's a big difference, you see, in saying that you see stars forming out there in a hydrogen cloud and actually seeing them form. We had a fellow by the name of Michael Seelick come down from the University of New Mexico to tell us how stars were formed in one of our Monday afternoon seminars at the University of Texas at El Paso. And when we got through, he hadn't told us a thing about how they'd formed. He spent the whole time telling us how they were destroyed. One has never seen stars form. But we've seen the opposite. We see people, what? Born but dying the moment they're born. We see things running down from the beginning. We see things wearing out. We don't see people growing younger. I wish I could say that we did. Some people look like they don't age any, but most of us look pretty bad. Every morning when I get up, I look like I'd stayed up all night at a stockholders meeting. That's what I think when I start shaving. Can't believe it. But anyway, that's what entropy does. We see people growing older. We see stars growing older. We see stars exploding. We see clusters of stars breaking up. We see clusters of galaxies tending to break up. This is what we observe. The creationist maintains that there is a downward movement of this universe that is not moving upward. Now, those are the two positions. They're contradictory to each other. They both can't be right. One says the universe is all there is self-contained. The other says, no, it is not self-contained. It is not an isolated system. There is a being outside it who interferes, so to speak, quotation marks, in his creation. He created the matter and energy in the first place and put the order into it. The other position, the evolutionist position, says this order arose spontaneously. The evolutionist position says things are developing upward, always, ever upward and onward, to better and better things. And the creationist position says, no, things are wearing out. They're running down. Order and form and body and complexity and information is being lost. The evolutionist position says things are very, very old, that they have to be old in order, you see, for this universe to have existed. You know, I forgot to look at my watch when I started on this. I hope I haven't already gone past my time, but anyway, I do that on purpose so I never know when I began, and I can always guess at it and then keep going for a while. But anyway, and my watch is set on mountain time anyway. You know, I'm from El Paso. But anyhow, I did forget to look, honestly. If I can remember what time it's saying here. I'll quit soon, though. I have a little bit more to say. The creationist position says things are young, or at least this creationist believes that, and I think there's a great deal of evidence for it. And tomorrow night, over at the University of California at Irvine, I'll present some arguments and evidence for that. Now, I would like to make a few comments here on the Big Bang tonight and talk about it just a little bit. If you take anybody on the street and ask them what the Big Bang was, they can tell you all about it. If there's anything known in astronomy, it's about the Big Bang, you know, that presumably occurred 15 to 20 billion years ago. That's been changed now to 8 to 10 billion years ago. since Hubble's constant got revised, and in the evolutionist scheme of things now, the universe is younger than any of the stars, you know, in it. When they revised the Hubble constant, it turned out, using that as their time scale, that you've got a universe that's younger than anything in it, which is a rather inconsistent situation, but that's the case at the present time. But anyway, presumably, anybody can tell you. My students can tell you all about the Big Bang, and if I tell them that I think that it is wrong, they seem to think I've insulted their mothers or something, and they hold it against me for the rest of the semester. It's like telling them that nobody knows where there are such things as black holes, you know. Really, nobody's ever seen one of the things. That's the reason they're called black holes. But astronomers, have been talking about them so long, they can tell you about their masses, they can tell you about their momenta, they can tell you how fast they're moving, they can tell you their sizes. Nobody's ever seen one of the things or even know they exist. When I tell my students, they really do hold that against me. That's even worse than doubting the Big Bang. When I tell them that no one's ever seen the things, and I have some serious doubts that they even exist, they really get upset over that. But the Big Bang is believed to be the explanation for things today. It holds a center stage of cosmogony being a study of origins, particularly astronomical origins. The story goes something like this. Once upon a time, now, it's really true. That's the way it should start, because it's just a story. It's what is referred to as a nature myth in philosophy. Once upon a time, there was a cosmic egg, or a primordial atom, or a primeval atom, and all of the matter and energy in this universe was packed into that primordial atom. It sat there for who knows how long, maybe for an eternity, maybe for an instant. Georges Lemaître, the fellow who thought it up in the first place, the Belgian abbot, he said it wasn't there very long, maybe. Just, you know, there for a little while, and then all of a sudden exploded. Today, the view is that it may have sat there for quite a long time, an eternity in itself. But anyway, suddenly an explosion occurred in this cosmic egg, or this primordial atom, or this primeval atom. Thing broke up into pieces, and the pieces were extremely small. Radiation and elementary particles being matter and antimatter. Neutrinos and antineutrinos, electrons and positrons, protons and antiprotons, particles you see in antiparticles. So out of this explosion came a mad rush of those elementary particles and radiation. And the radiation and the matter were all coupled together to start with. But as the thing began to move apart, reactions took place, and you got hydrogen formed, you got the radiation separated from the elementary particles, and it zoomed right on out. And there you had elementary particles coming out a bit slower and so forth. But you had hydrogen formed, and then presumably through reactions you had helium formed. Well, back in the early days when Georges Lemaître proposed the Big Bang, the idea was you'd get all of the elements formed in that explosion. But they never could theoretically get past mass number 5. And so they stopped with helium and then had the whole thing you see formed in stars, the rest of the elements later on when stars form. Now this thing expanding tremendously rapidly, with uniform properties in all directions, with uniform motion in all directions, no rotational motion associated with it, merely radial motion from the point of the explosion. And somewhere along the line, the brakes got put on, and stars and galaxies were formed, and eventually you. You know, a planetary system about the sun, and on one of the planets, third one out from the sun, as they say in science fiction stories, third one out from the sun, you formed by chance processes down the line. Now, there are a number of things that one could object to such a story as this that are extremely important. And the reason I want to mention it is this is an idea that is accepted by so many people. It is, of course, one of the many attempts to explain this universe without any recourse to, you see, a supernatural being by getting your universe so that it is completely independent and the beings in it are independent of God. In the first place, there are a number of troubles. If all of the matter and energy were packed into a volume of space, the size of that primordial atom that these people propose, you'd have a black hole of all black holes. You see, back when Georges Lemaître proposed the idea, he said this primordial atom or this primeval atom was infinite in size. You know, the universe then was about as big as it was now, and the egg just sort of broke up into pieces already with the size. But that idea was given up. And later on, George Gamow of George Washington University, and later on the University of Colorado, He said that the size of that primordial atom, or the primeval egg, cosmic egg, was about the size of the solar system in diameter. But today, you'll never guess what its size is. Well, after that, they reduced it down to the size of a pinhead. But today, that's vast. That's vast size in comparison to what is believed the size of the primordial atom. We had a fellow come out from the University of Texas at Austin to lecture on our campus. And on the UTEP campus, we're very jealous of our intellectual image. We're on the backside of the desert, and we worry a lot about what they think about us down at Austin, since they control the purse strings down there and the budget and everything. Well, this fellow in our Monday afternoon seminar, this physicist, he got up and said the primordial atom, in which all of the matter and energy in the universe was concentrated, was in a volume of space no larger than an electron. Well, our graduate students sat there through that. They didn't wiggle a muscle. They have learned to go to sleep 5 minutes after 4. The lecture starts at 4 always. They have learned to automatically go to sleep with their eyes open. They didn't even hear him say that. They were sitting there and asleep with their eyes open. They wake up at 5 minutes to 5 because all lecturers, we lay the law down, they have to stop at 5 o'clock. That's when we head for supper. And we're certainly not going to listen to any lecture past 5 o'clock. So they wake up at 5 minutes to 5 with a question ready on whatever the subject is. Nobody laughed or smiled when that fellow said all of the matter. Can you imagine 100 billion stars in a typical galaxy, 1,000 billion galaxies in the observable universe, and who knows how much matter and energy, you know, in between all of this. This fellow said it was all concentrated in a volume of space originally, no larger than an electron. I've got billions of them right between my fingers there. As a matter of fact, he said every bit of it was in that volume of space. You couldn't even see the thing, in other words. If there was ever a black hole, there was one. If there's ever been one. Now, the first question that arises then, if all of the matter and energy were concentrated in a volume of space like that, how in the world did they ever explode the thing in the first place? Because, you see, it has an infinite density. It has an infinitesimal volume. An infinite density and an infinitesimal volume gives you an infinite gravitational, self-gravitational field for the thing. And how in the world do you break up something that's held together by infinite forces? So it's off to a bad start to begin with. But suppose you got the thing exploded, and out of the explosion you got those elementary particles that I mentioned. Now, elementary particles contain what is referred to as matter and antimatter. Now, when matter and antimatter get together, it's goodbye, Charlie, because they annihilate each other, you know. And so out of this explosion come the particles and antiparticles. Well, to begin with, they have to be close to each other. And if they're close to each other, the first question arises, how in the world did the thing keep from destroying itself, you know, right back? Because there they are together. And if you say, well, somehow or other it all survived, this is a universe in which it is very difficult to find any antimatter, maybe a stray particle once in a while, but certainly extremely rare, and only recently demonstrated that it did exist in space, and some people have doubts that the demonstration was correct. But anyway, where are all those antiparticles? For every particle, you've got to have an antiparticle. Where has it all gone, you see, if this is the explanation for the origin of the universe? Another question arises, and, oh my goodness, it can't be this time, but I guess it is. I'll hurry along on this. Another question that arises, if all of this is spreading out at a tremendously fast speed, how did it ever slow down enough to form stars and galaxies? See, the idea is that a star forms from gravitational collapse of hydrogen clouds. How in the world did you ever get it to slow down enough? Well, Georges Lemaître said what happened was the self-gravitation of this rapidly expanding cloud put the brakes on it and brought it to a stop. Now, he said stop. He really meant stop. He didn't mean that it was just coasting along gradually, you know, and somehow stars and galaxies were forming. The thing actually stopped, he said, came to a static state. You folks in physics know what that means. The thing came to a halt. And he said there were nuclei of condensation developing here and there in this cloud, you see, that had come to a stop. And where those nuclei of condensation developed, gravitational forces brought more matter in, and you had your stars forming. Now, you've got to keep in mind, how many stars do you have to form? Well, for a typical galaxy, 100 billion of them. And how many galaxies? 1,000 billion galaxies. There's got to be a lot of nuclei of condensation in this huge cloud, you see. And when you multiply those numbers together, it's quite a bit. And not only must you form those stars and galaxies, but you've got to form not just stars and galaxies, but you have to form clusters of stars. See, stars come in clusters usually, groups. And you have to form not only clusters of stars, but you have to form galaxies, because galaxies are what this universe is composed. And you have to form not only galaxies, but what? Clusters of galaxies, because galaxies don't appear singly. They're always in groups or clusters. And then you remember I mentioned that cluster of clusters? Got to have those clusters of clusters too. So it's a rather complicated thing. But what else must you have with it? They've got to be rotating as well, because everything rotates as well as translates. You see, the idea is that that this Big Bang explanation is the correct one, because you have a redshift of the galaxies and everything looks like it's moving apart. But you see, the supposed evidence for the Big Bang is galaxies moving apart. But what was produced in the Big Bang? Particles and energy. How do you jump? See, this was Lemaître's problem. How do you jump from particles and energy to galaxies? Because the universe is made up of these galaxies. Well, I told you how he said it, but there was one problem. Here it is, sitting stopped. What's the proof for the Big Bang, supposedly? An expanding universe. Redshift to the light from galaxies, which is interpreted to mean what? Objects receding from us, moving away from us. If the thing is stopped, how do you get it started again? You know, Newton's first law of motion, you physics students, you know, which says that a body will continue whatever state of motion it's in, moving in a straight line with uniform motion unless acted upon by an unbalanced external force. Well, there are no external forces, are there? No unbalanced external forces, because the universe is all there is. Things sitting there in a static state, equilibrium, how do you get it to expand? You can't explode it again, can you? If you explode it again, it's goodbye, Charlie, for the universe. There's no universe. You're right back where you started if you explode the thing again. Presumably, you see the expansion came out of the explosion. But you can't go back to that explosion, because there go all those stars and galaxies if you explode the thing. How do you get to start? Well, Lemaître did it very well. It's enough to make a physicist's hair stand straight up. That's why my hair is so straight and no curl in it whatsoever. He said, and I read his papers in the French back when I was a graduate student. He said, after he explained how the stars and galaxies formed, this was his statement, just a flat statement. He said, then the expansion resumed. Well, as I say, see, I told you, I noticed a number of fellows out there whose hair straightened out immediately with that statement. Some of those physics majors that you have in your congregation here from the university, their hair straightened out immediately. They'll never be able to comb it back down after this. But anyway, this is what he said. Well, that's, of course, a horrible violation of the most elementary physics that a freshman student studies. Well, nobody particularly believes Lemaître today. So the idea is that today this thing can't slow down. If it slows down, it's going to fall back in on itself. It'll collapse gravitationally. So the idea is today we're just going to have to form those stars and galaxies on the run. You know, with all of this moving apart, they're just going to have to come together on the run. But there's trouble with that. The running is too fast. The hypothetical cloud that came out of the Big Bang is expanding so rapidly that on the basis of gravitational mechanics and fluid mechanics, there's no other way in the world you can get it to come together. You can't develop these gravitational instabilities in this rapidly expanding cloud to form those stars and galaxies. There was a Russian astronomer, mathematician, physicist by the name of Lifshitz back in 1946 in a paper in the Soviet Journal of Physics, a paper entitled Gravitational Instabilities in an Expanding Universe. He showed that it was an impossibility, that you could not develop instabilities in which you could form stars and galaxies in an expanding universe as proposed by the Big Bang people. I was down in Australia lecturing some time ago, and a graduate student at the University of Adelaide who had just finished his doctoral dissertation on the formation of galaxies came up after I'd finished lecturing and had mentioned what Lifshitz had said, and he said his work had shown the same thing, that Lifshitz was exactly right. There was no way to form galaxies in a Big Bang universe. There was no way to get stars out of this. The whole thing is moving so rapidly, you see, that there's no way to get it to come together to form these stars and galaxies in the first place. But a second question arises. How in the world, suppose you got stars and galaxies, would you get them to rotate? Now see, it's a cloud that's moving uniformly in all directions. Now those are not my words, really. That's what you can read in any elementary astronomy textbook. Uniform motion and uniform properties everywhere in it. You know, that means uniform temperatures, uniform densities, everything uniform. There is something about uniformity that evolutionists love. I don't know what it is exactly, but that's a favorite word with them. They like that idea of uniformity in things. But if it is expanding uniformly, where does any rotational motion come from? Because you see, it's moving out radially from the region of the explosion, which means you have only what is referred to in physics as radial momentum and no angular momentum. And if you have no radial, if you have only radial momentum, and everything, all forces balance, you see, sideways, because everything is uniform in this cloud, there's no way to develop any kind of rotational motion. I was in a debate in Holland at Utrecht 2 years ago, and my opponent was a Dutch astronomer by the name of Koppensharth, University of Amsterdam. And we, after we gave our lectures for 25 minutes each, you, I know, consider that must have been impossible for me, well, nearly. But anyway, after 25 minutes of my rambling around, trying to figure out what to say in 25 minutes, we got to question each other. And I asked him where the rotational motion in the universe came from, if he proposed the Big Bang, which he did. And he hemmed and hawed and never gave an answer. So I decided to give an answer for him, for the audience, and told him that the only way you could get rotational motion, which he knew good and well, was by having torques develop, you see, in your cloud, sideways forces tending to rotate a body, you know. And I said, if you have a uniform cloud, it's impossible to develop torques. And pointed out to that Dutch audience that any freshman student in physics at the University of Texas at El Paso knew good and well that you couldn't get rotational motion from something like that, and it was impossible. Well, then finally, and I'm skipping most of this to tell you the objections to the Big Bang, but there's one last thing I'll point out, and it's what I've already touched on some, and that's this matter of entropy, or the second law of thermodynamics. If you have an explosion, in all experience, explosion produces disorder, doesn't it? Geophysicists set off explosions in the earth to create noise, and then by very sophisticated instruments, they pick up certain signals in that noise, pick out a certain part of that noise and look at it. And from that noise, then they analyze the structure of the crust of the earth in looking for oil-bearing structures. However, nobody ever pretends that an explosion produces order. Suppose I told you that as I flew up on Golden West Airlines from San Diego up here today, it's the only flight I own, the airline I could get a flight on, or get a seat on, they flew low to the ground, 8,000 feet instead of way up high. Well, anyway, suppose I told you that I saw some hill explode, you know, down there. Being that close to the ground, one can see things happening. I saw something explode, a mountain explode, and as that mountain, the fragments of the mountain, the dust and the rock and so forth, settled down, a city was created. Back in New Mexico, over east of Las Cruces, west of Las Cruces, rather, there's a city called Rock City. You know, it's where those boulders got heaped up in a certain way. Kind of looks like buildings and so forth, slightly, not much. One has to really stretch his imagination to imagine a city there, those rocks, those boulders all tumbled around, but it's for all the tourists, you know, to come in there with the quarters and a dollar to get in to see the Rock City. Then they turn out rather disappointed. It wasn't much of a city. But anyway, suppose I told you I saw this mountain explode and the fragments settled out, and out of it there were streets and buildings, so forth, you know, the things that constitute a city. Well, you wouldn't pay a bit of attention to me tonight, would you? Well, suppose I told you that I saw an atom explode, no larger than an electron, and out of it I saw 10 to the 23rd number of stars form. And I saw 10 to the 13th number of galaxies form. And I saw people form. And I saw out of a shallow sea some wiggly little thing develop all of a sudden that presumably was life to start with. Why do people believe that sort of a story? Whereas if you look at it on a probability basis, there's sure a far better chance for a mountain exploding and forming a rock city than a universe forming out of the explosion of an electron. By the way, if you want to calculate on probability basis, a sure better chance on one than the other, for that matter. But you wouldn't believe it at all. Because there is something called the second law of thermodynamics that seems to operate in this universe that says if a system starts out with a certain amount of information, it can never get more information than what it started with. Isn't that right? And as time goes on, what will happen to it? It won't even end up with as much as it started with. It'll lose it. And after a while, it'll have the minimum amount of information in it. Or in other words, an isolated system never becomes what? Ordered. It becomes disordered. Unless there's an interference from the outside. when you're down at the beach, suppose you stay down at the beach, you're standing in all of those photons of light coming from the sun, plenty of energy pouring in there. What will happen to you if you don't go off occasionally to get a bite to eat? Well, you'll die eventually, won't you? You'll be the tannest corpse on the beach after a bit, as well as the skinniest corpse on the beach, for that matter. If you don't go off and get a bite to eat, a steak or a hamburger or something or the other once in a while, because even though you're standing in a sea of energy, and even though there's all of it around everywhere, the human body can only use what? A certain form of energy. It has mechanisms that can use chemical energy and convert that chemical energy into heat energy to run the mechanisms in the cells and to keep the fluids flowing properly and to build, new tissue and so forth from sub-constituent elements. But it can't just take any ordinary energy. What I'm getting at is this. Without a mechanism, raw energy cannot give you order, you see. There must be something that is, so to speak, outside it all that takes energy and takes matter and creates complexity and function and body and form and arrangement. This doesn't happen spontaneously, or we don't see it happening spontaneously. Why will you eat a bite of supper tonight? Maybe after I get through, you may be so hungry when I get through lecturing you tonight, you may have to get a bite. Why do you? The real reason is you need that energy that comes out of it to keep the order in your body. Really, you're fighting against that second law. You may not know it, but the next time you have a big dinner, remember that's the reason that you're eating, whether you know it or not. Have you seen that commercial on television that has a bunch of people sitting around drinking old so-and-so beer? And every time they mention old so-and-so beer, a huge steer crashes in the window and creates all sorts of disorder. You know, the drinkers head in all directions to get out of the way of that rampaging steer. That's what raw energy does to a system. It creates disorder. Now, how do you get order? Put a halter on that steer, hook him up to some sort of machine, and then let the drinker say old so-and-so, mention the name of old so-and-so beer, and let him come storming in then, and he'll what? Lift a weight, or maybe do some useful work of some sort if you've got him hitched up. But what I'm saying is the second law of thermodynamics says that things run down when left to themselves. There is no natural tendency in matter and energy to create order, but there is a natural tendency for what? Disorder to arise. What I'm saying is then, out of the explosion of the primordial atom, how could you ever get order or a universe such as we have, in which bodies possess rotational motion, bodies possess translational motion, bodies possess means of generating energy, either by gravitational collapse or through thermonuclear reactions, and there are complicated manners of transmission of that energy from one point to another in this universe, and you have the complicated arrangements of matter itself forming these bodies. This is something that, according to the second law of thermodynamics, will not arise spontaneously. The second law of thermodynamics says this is a universe that is what? Running down. It had to start out as what? Cosmos, and is headed toward chaos, because no natural systems can go from what? Chaos to cosmos spontaneously. One last example. If you take a watch, you've seen those old self-winding kind, Timex cells, so forth. if you wiggle your arm different ways, it'll wind itself. It doesn't really wind itself, does it? Suppose you take this Accutron of mine, the battery is dead. I can wiggle my arms in all different directions, my wrist, and the thing sits there as dead as a doornail. It doesn't wind itself at all. What's in that self-winding watch? A mechanism that involves intelligence and ability that takes what? Random motions and converts them into an ordered form of motion of what? Turning the hands on the watch. It's not something that arises spontaneously or by chance. Without that device in the watch, you don't have a self-winding watch. The physical laws do not give rise to the universe. The universe seems to obey the physical laws. But it is absurd to say what? The physical laws give rise to this watch. Or physical laws give rise to the universe. It appears to me, and this is my last sentence, this may be the longest sentence in the history of Costa Mesa or this church, but anyway, this is my last sentence. It appears to me, in the light of the second law of thermodynamics, that naturalistic explanations that say this universe started out independent, started out in a chaotic condition, and became the cosmos that we observe is absolutely false scientifically, absurd scientifically, a violation of everything we talk about in physics. This universe is not the product of chance and selection, and as John Wheeler at Princeton University, now down at the University of Texas at Austin, once said, he said he viewed the universe as the product of chance and selection and hope. That's absurd for a physicist to be talking that way, really. That's a parenthesis in that sentence. That's absurd. This universe is not something could have arisen by that sort, because when you look at it on the basis of the laws of physics, that sort of thing is impossible. This universe having order, not having gone to a state of minimum order, maximum disorder, which is a state in which it is a dead universe, in which there will be no processes taking place, if it is losing order, it must have had what? More order in the past. It had to be complicated in the past. It had to start out as cosmos in the past, not chaos. This is a universe that cries out, when you look at it, that it had to have been created. It had to start out as a discontinuity, a singularity. I believe the universe was created by God, as the book of Genesis says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. This is by far the best explanation, by far, looking at it scientifically or any way you want to look at it, the most reasonable explanation, because where, looking at things scientifically, do you ever see things arising by chance? Certainly, stars and galaxies. It appears to me that this universe is the result of the action, an instantaneous action, an action of a being that is all-powerful, all-intelligent, and certainly all-wonderful to have created such a magnificent, wonderful universe. But best of all, as we know from the scriptures, this same one who created this magnificent universe was the one who sent his Son to die on the cross and was resurrected, and through grace gives us salvation, which is in itself a far, far more wonderful thing even than the creation of this most wonderful, magnificent universe. Thank you for inviting me over to...
You know, simply put, it just makes sense. I mean, it's reasonable. I can demonstrate chaos all around by just systems let go. I cannot demonstrate any complex forms arising spontaneously. The whole philosophical system that has prevailed in our educational institutions over the last century is that of existentialism, which must take the leap from reality, which they say is destined to lead a person into despair. And thus, the philosophers declare you must take a leap of faith into a non-reasoned religious experience in order to survive. And as far as I can see and understand, that leap of faith that they have taken into non-reasoned religious experience is that leap of faith into the evolutionary hypothesis. It is a religious system, but it surely is a non-reasoned religious system. But it is necessary for them to survive to take that leap of faith, and to trust that though it cannot be demonstrated, some way, somehow, somewhere, order and life came out of disorder. The Christian experience is not a non-reasoned religious experience. God said, "Come now, let us reason together, saith the Lord." And there is plenty of reason for believing in Jesus Christ. And there is plenty of reason for the hope that we have in us of eternal life through Him. We appreciate so much Dr. Schlesser coming and sharing with us tonight. And I know that when you look at it with a rational mind, you see how foolish are the things that men choose to believe when they choose not to believe in Jesus Christ. You know, any old thing will do. Any explanation. How much wiser to just choose to believe in Jesus Christ. That's the reason why years ago in college I decided that I wasn't an atheist. Because it was easier to believe in God than not to believe in God. If I chose not to believe in God, then there were too many difficulties to explain. I had no explanation for the universe, for myself, for anything around me. So I said, well, there must be a God. And I chose to believe in God. But I couldn't rest there. If God does exist, then there must be a reason why He exists, and there must be a reason why He made me. And I began my quest to understand and to know God, who I came to know through Jesus Christ in a very real and wonderful way. Faith in God is a matter of choice. Your choice. You can choose to believe in Jesus Christ. You can choose not to believe in Jesus Christ. God even gave you the capacity of choice, so you could. It's just a matter of choice. If you choose not to believe in Jesus Christ, then you can create all kinds of fanciful arguments of how the whole thing started with an electron exploding and developing into these complex orders of the universe. And the more complex orders of life forms within the universe on the planet Earth. And you can create your arguments and your reasons. This is why I don't believe. Let me tell you something. You'll never rest in them. You create them, but you'll never rest in them. But if you choose to believe in Jesus Christ, then plenty of evidence. Enough evidence to fully satisfy your choice can be demonstrated. Plus the experience. It's a matter of choice. But look how hard they have to work who've chosen not to. Look at the fanciful tales they have to believe. Look at the impossible vagaries that they have to accept. It's a lot easier to believe. It's a lot wiser choice. Especially when you consider the end result.